listening to the Berkman Audio Fishbowl from the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. Each week, we feature conversations with leading cyber scholars, entrepreneurs, activists, and policymakers as they explore the bleeding edge of the internet and technology, democracy, law, and society. For more information on the Berkman Center, and for more programs like this, visit cyber.law.harvard.edu.
Great. So, Jeff is going to talk about crowdsourcing. Jeff is a contributing editor at Wired Magazine. He was a journalist for 15 years, and before he started giving away the profession and loosing it to crowdsourcing, he'll maybe talk about that a little bit. Jeff totally owns this topic. He coined the term, I guess, in 2006, is that right?
That's right, yeah.
Which is remarkable, because it feels like it's been part of our lexicon for two decades now, but in any case, 2006, and he has now written the book on it, which is a great read. I recommend it, and with no further to do, it's yours.
I lied, though. I'm not, I just have to grab, I just gotta get left, hold on one
second. And he never comes back.
This is.
I'm ready to give my talk.
Well, I guess we're the crowd.
All right. That's it. Okay.
Right. Who wants to deliver talk? Slide one? One volunteer, please.
Can I just say one more anecdote about Jeff that none of you can see except Ethan and I can see, is that he has one of the most beat up laptops you'll ever see, and he's missing a key. It's not the W key, but mysteriously the one to the left of that, which I think is a Q.
It is a Q.
Someone who writes about QWERTY a lot.
All right. Okay, now I'm ready. So, hi, everyone. Thank you very much. I'm really, really happy to be here. I'm really here for selfish reasons. I was told this is a great format in which to download, and that's really why I'm here, is to try to provoke discussion. So selfish though, non-monetary reasons. When I set out to write my book, I faced a question that every author faces, which what kind of book am I going to write? It was my first book, and the answer was pretty quickly evident. It would be inappropriate to pretend I could maintain anything like an objective stance toward this phenomenon that I was calling crowdsourcing. But from the beginning, I had deep ambivalencies about it. I saw it as having both positive and negative consequences on our culture and our economy. But I'm not a polemicist. I don't possess the methodological skills or tools of the academic. I'm not an essayist, and I certainly don't have the background in business to write a how to crowdsource your business book, although Crown's marketing staff definitely did their best to convince readers otherwise. I'm a journalist, and so I decided that what I wanted to do was write a book of stories, ideally showing crowdsourcing's promise, as well as its perils. In the sort of semi-controlled process that was this 10-month mad dash to both research and write the book, there was sort of an unfortunate occurrence. I wound up erring too far in the direction of simply proving that the phenomenon was real, and not enough in questioning how it worked, and how its promises might be accentuated and its perils ameliorated. By the same token, I so concentrated on collecting anecdotes and the telling of those anecdotes, which is, after all, what we're trained to do in journalism, that I neglected to collect any sort of quantitative data. There was a little bit that I could rely on, but given the challenge in writing a book about, where you're at once writing about a phenomenon and sort of identifying it at the same time, is almost by definition, there's not a lot of data to lean on. Just as I was wrapping up edits, I learned of a study conducted on some 650 contributors to iStock Photo. Do people here know iStock Photo? Right, thanks. I hate to ask.
I don't know it.
Okay, yeah. Well, we're actually... It's fine. We're going to get into it. I actually... Can I get water?
Sure.
I'm sorry, thanks. So, yeah, a survey to some 650 iStock contributors. iStock Photo was you know, one of, and in fact, probably the primary case study that I looked at in my book. And while the study didn't exactly contradict the conclusions that I drew, both looking at iStock Photo and sort of about crowdsourcing generally, it did problematize them. Having spent a week in the offices of iStock Photo, just really quickly so you know, iStock Photo is, as it sounds, it's a stock photo agency, but they really revolutionized the field of stock photography by charging, basically undercutting traditional purveyors of stock images by 99%. Instead of charging $250, $300, $350, they were charging a buck. Why? Why were they able to do this? They were capitalizing on the transformation of the usable digital image from a scarce commodity to an abundant commodity. The fact is that a great number of people who would not be thought of as professional photographers were more than happy to upload their entire portfolio. iStock would do a cursory search of them, pick, say, the best fifth, the best third, and then market these for very little money. So in spending the amount of, I spent a lot of time, over a week in the offices itself and countless hours interviewing contributors as well as people within iStock, I'd been caught up in the community is the company ethos of the place. And they do a very good job of really running all corporate decisions by their community, by the community itself. The logic of this is essentially that people gather on iStock for the community and that selling photos is more of a fortunate byproduct of that. Darren Carroll Brabham, a University of Utah graduate student who conducted the survey, his respondents had more complicated motivations, and it left me wanting to revisit the question of motivation in contributors to crowdsourcing. Fortunately, I got this survey just as I was putting the very finishing touches on the book. So, this is one of several questions that I, would really like to revisit, be it in an article, series of blog posts, perhaps another book. So I've come here with questions more than answers. I'm hoping to provoke discussion and come away with a better understanding of why people contribute to, we can call this crowdsourcing, we can call it, I like the term community production, to these sorts of projects. What I want to do really quickly so that you all have, a rough understanding of what I talk about in my book is I'm going to try the speed trial of giving my talk. It's a 45-minute talk. We're going to do it in 5 minutes. So this is my book. This started, I got the idea because in 2005 I was doing a story about MySpace, not as a social networking site, which people weren't sure at that time that it was. What was clear was that bands, models, people in LA, creatives were using it to circumvent the gatekeepers, the music labels, et cetera, and go straight to their fans, sell merchandise, book tours, et cetera. In doing this, I spent a lot of time with the kids on the Vans Warped Tour, and what I noticed was that they had a very different relationship with technology than my peers did, and certainly older demographics did, that they were what I thought of as promiscuously creative. And that a lot of the output of this promiscuous creativity was from an aesthetic perspective, perhaps not high quality, that it was the relationship that fascinated me, and specifically the relationship with the process of creativity, that I felt that web design for them, digital photography, videography, illustration, flash animation, had their relationship with these tools had become like our relationship to typing or the pencil, that there was a transparency there, that it was the ease of use was a fundamental transformation. This wasn't a particularly new thought at the time, but I felt that this was all going under this rubric of user-generated content. I was asked, in which I felt was I just despised the phrase user-generated content. And I also felt that it just didn't begin to tap the transformation that was actually taking place. None of this wound up in the article. Several months later, I was asked to give a talk about this piece that I'd written on MySpace. And the night before, I decided that instead of talking about user-generated content, I wanted to talk about user-generated anything. And so I just spent the night searching for stuff, anything that could back up this hypothesis that this was something that went beyond kids making little videos in MySpace pages. And what I found was really lovely. Does everyone know what John Fluvog shoes are? Chunky grunge era. John Fluvog is a shoe designer out of Vancouver. His shoes are very popular, in the early 90s, but they maintain a core and passionate audience. And knowing this as he did, he started a program back in 2001 called Open Source Footwear. And the idea was to turn this into this. And he encouraged people, not would-be shoe designers, but his passionate user base, to design a shoe. And the more sketchy, the better. On the back of a napkin, an envelope, anything. And that if he liked it, he would make it, and he wouldn't give you any money, but he would name the shoe after you. And this thin claim to fame was enough, fame of a sort, was enough to drive, a number of contributions. As far as I know, Fluvog, it's still a successful program, small program, but successful. So this is what I looked like when I gave my talk, and no one knew what the hell I was talking about. But I was able to call my editor and say, look, I think I'm onto something here. You just get a sense. Your spidey sense tingles when you feel like you have a feature in the works. And the metaphor I developed at the time was that in discussing user-generated content, we were all looking at essentially Old Faithful. And Old Faithful was, imagine if you'd never seen a geyser before, an amazing phenomenon striking consistency. It blows every 18 and a half minutes or whatever it is, and it's wondrous to behold. But that what everyone was missing is that the phenomenon itself wasn't the geyser, it was the magma underneath. And that if we could pull back and maybe given the luxury of a bit of time as well, what we would see is that this same phenomenon was creating, geysers all over the place. And to sort of tie up the analogy, those other geysers would be the emergence of in other fields of this blurring of the line between producer and consumer. For a number of reasons that I'll get into quickly, people were, the barrier to entry to create stuff, to create solutions, to create products, to have a more meaningful interaction with producers, would be taking place in all sorts of fields. This became the rise of crowdsourcing. And article came out in June 2006. This was a screenshot taken just a couple weeks before the article hit. All of those people either worked at Wired or slept with people who worked at Wired. And this was a couple weeks afterwards. So, the term itself really exploded. I mean, this is not the best article I've written. I was proud of it. A lot of research went into it. It was far from a masterpiece of style of prose styling, but the term itself was sort of right place, right time. My feeling is that a lot of other people felt the same way I did, that they sensed that magma beneath the surface and that there just wasn't a name for it. In Chris Anderson longtail fashion, the article became a blog, and the blog became a book. What I've really enjoyed about studying this is that it's not something that came out of Harvard Business School or Wharton or the consulting offices of Booz Allen or McKinsey, but that it just came up organically. This is an example of such. This is Jake Nickel. This is Jacob DeHart. In around 2000, they met on a graphic design community forum called Dreamless. Around that time, Dreamless held a t-shirt competition, and Jacob DeHart won it with this shirt, which it's very self-referential, the shirt itself referring to a specific forum thread that ever had been controversial, and that's why it won. But at any rate, the two Jakes, as they later became known, had an idea of why just do this on the forum? Why not? This was so much fun. Let's just have a perpetual t-shirt design competition. And it was a pretty straightforward idea. They threw up a website. People would design, come up with a design. They would attach it to a template and submit it. People would chatter about it. And then they would pick a winner. Except that the Jakes came to a fateful decision. I like to think that for people who've really come up using the internet, democracy becomes a habit of mind. And whereas 10 or 15 years ago, the Jakes might have invited a celebrated designer to pick the shirts, or more likely, straightest line from A to B, just pick the winning shirt themselves, they decided instead, why not just throw up a voting mechanism? Is this totally old for people? Does everyone here know Threadless? Yes? No? Yeah, hands on yes, because I'll really dash through it. Mm-hmm. All right, so I'll sort of do my best to go really quickly. I just love this. This is my favorite shirt. It's Make a Last Wish. Okay. This is how you vote on it. And that having been accomplished in something like 0.03 seconds, while my coffee break is still going on, I'm going to score like 15 other shirts. So the brilliant thing in Jake's fateful decision was that it opened up a community that had been for people who loved t-shirt design and loved to make t-shirt design to people who like to vote on cool designs, which includes, if not quite everyone, a lot of people who might not necessarily be qualified as designers. In doing so, they created a pretty amazing labor force. This is what cheap labor used to look like. I'm frozen here. And this is what it looks like today. So this was a very propitious decision for the Jakes. This is Threadless's revenues. This started, again, as a side project. This was something they were doing for fun, and I think this is very important, to please their community. They stopped letting me know what they got smart in 2008 and stopped telling me how much money they were making. Although, as far as I know, they still have something in the region of 34% profit margin. So it's an enormously profitable company, a private company, and they've resisted all sorts of buyout offers. So it's worth looking really quickly at how they've accomplished this. And first is, this unique labor force, if you want to call it that, the community would be a better term for it. The Threadless community does, I think, three things for Threadless. One is that provides the designs themselves. And why do they do this? One is, they now, the prize money is pretty decent. It's over $2,000. $2,000 check and $500 in kind, so you can buy t-shirts with it, store credit. And if you win, you not only get the money, but if you have, who can guess what this is? Everyone, right? Communist Party?
The Communist Party.
There you go. You can. It's the best-selling Threadless T-shirt. Every time they reprint this, they pay the designer $500, and better yet, the designer has become fairly well known within this subculture as the designer of the Communist Party T-shirt. The second thing that the community does is they self-evangelize. Threadless has never spent a dime in marketing or advertising. This is a quick snapshot of the hundreds of people who've taken photos of themselves wearing the Communist Party T-shirt for $1.50 in store credit. I mean, to that extent, it is a budget item, I suppose. But the third and most interesting thing that they do is, beyond voting, they throw up this "I'd buy it" widget on every shirt site. And what that gives them is an incredibly fine-tuned gauge of exactly how many people will actually, pull out their wallet and shell out the $15-$20 for an individual T-shirt. Threadless has never had overstock. They've never not sold out of a run of T-shirts. So around the same time that Threadless was starting, Bruce Livingstone, the founder of iStock Photo, was a web designer living in Calgary. And he, a former punk rock musician that he was, he'd been on tour for years. He had a really wide network of creatives, musicians, but also other designers. He did fairly well as a web designer, but he found himself spending a lot of his time doing pro bono work for friends, for bands, making CD covers and the like. And what he discovered was that he would either have to pay a lot of money to license a stock image and foot the bill himself, or he would be forced to pass the cost of that on to his friends. And the whole idea was to not burden them with that sort of outlay. And so what Livingstone did was, he had an idea. I'm a photographer, a pretty bad one, but I will upload all of my images. He had a big portfolio, and anyone can use them. And in exchange, all they have to do is upload their own photos. So, a pretty straight forward, internet credit system, right out of the Ware scene. Like, you could download 3 images for every image that you uploaded. And it was good. It became very, very popular. I love this. Jeffrey Zeldman's fairly well-known designer, and I love these quotes. I hate reading my slides. Can everyone read it?
No.
I will. So iStockPhoto.com does wonderful work and gives it away for free. What's the catch? There isn't one. Why do they do it? I'm just guessing here, but my sense is that they do it for the same reason a lot of us put things up on the web, so others can enjoy and work with what we've created. So Bruce came to a fateful decision. He could no longer afford hosting costs for this. To the extent that there was a selfish motivation here, it was really so he just would no longer have to pay $300 every time he wanted to license an image. But he was going out of pocket to support what was essentially, we could think of as he certainly agrees with that quote from Jeffrey Zeldman, a gift to other people. He was just trying to do something cool for people he really liked. But he couldn't support it anymore. And so he decided to start charging a quarter. And what this did is it opened the system up, just as Threadless had done. So instead of having to upload your own images, all you had to do was pay a quarter for the image. And pretty quickly, consumers of images figured out that there was a place where you could pay a quarter instead of $300. And photographers figured out that, amateur photographers figured out that there was a place where you could actually get your work published. And you might not make a lot of money, but you would have fun, and there were a lot of other cool people who were there and on the forums. And this was good. Double-digit growth ensued. And to give an idea of why this transformed the stock photo industry, we have a little game. Who can pick the $300 image here? Is it A or B? A? Who says A? Hands on A. Hands on B. I forget. I totally do. I've given this talk it seems like a million times. And the number of hands has never exceeded one way or the other, like a 60-40 ratio. I mean, people don't know. This is Mark Harmel. When I first interviewed him for the story, micro stocks, which are what iStock Photo and Shutterstock and Dreamstime and a bunch of their competitors are called as a genre of photo agency, had taken about a 10% hit of his budget of his revenues. By the time I was wrapping up the book, that was closer to a 50% hit. At first, the professionals, both the agencies like Getty and Corbis, they're sort of the Coke and Pepsi of the stock photo world, had aligned against the micro stocks. There was a real sort of heathens at the gate, feeling about these. And then right as I was finishing up my article, Jonathan Klein decided to buy iStock Photo for $50 million, saying, someone's going to cannibalize my business, better it be one of my other businesses. It was, as it turns out, the wisest decision that he could have made, because iStock's photo, after he bought it, you can see what happened to their revenues. This was on a 50% profit margin, enormously profitable company. In this same time period, by the way, that's that 2012 figure, Getty went private, and as part of that commissioned Goldman, they had been a public company and were in dire trouble because of exactly this phenomenon. Goldman Sachs did a study projecting revenues of all their businesses. This was their projection for iStock Photo. Their projection for Getty, what had been Getty's core business, which is rights managed photography, which is essentially very high-end, professionally produced images, was expected to, worse than flat. Not quite fall off a cliff, but to go into considerable decline. 18 minutes. I'm not doing too bad. We have other examples, which I won't get into. This is Ed Mulcarrick. Ed is had been training as a physicist when he had to drop out of the University of Vancouver and go back to Toronto to care for his ailing mother. He spent the ensuing several decades. Basically, he had his master's in electrical engineering. He was sort of a journeyman engineer. When I met him, he was designing and installing HVAC systems in Barrie, Ontario, about an hour north of Toronto. He has since. Do we know what Innocentive is? More or less, it's like a bulletin board that companies can post problems they can't solve. Their corporate R&D problems can't. That they've had trouble with, and scientists, I think the network's up to 140,000 scientists from all around the world will then try and solve them. Ed is their most successful solver, and he solved some 8 problems, has probably earned well into 6 figures for that. One of my favorite examples, which unfortunately I'm pushing 20 minutes here, so I won't get into, is ornithology and the way that an amateur base of bird watchers has transformed the way ornithologists work. If someone wants to ask a question about that, I'd love to answer it. Current TV, where roughly a third of the content is what they call viewer-created content. I got this call. I used to always say, well, it's, people would ask, where does crowdsourcing end? And I said, well, it ends with products that can be reduced to bits and bytes. If it can be weighed and measured, I'm not sure. I don't see how crowdsourcing would work. But then the Washington Post called me and said, what do you think about crowdsourcing in restaurants? I was like, I don't think anything about crowdsourcing in restaurants. And it turns out that a restaurateur had married a social media entrepreneur. They wanted to create a business together. So instead of just opening a restaurant, it's probably me embarrassing you enough. Instead of just opening a restaurant, they opened the community first, and they gathered like 300 people in the Washington area to basically come to a consensus on what kind of restaurant they should open. Raw foods was the choice, where it should open, what the decor should be. I'm going to dash through this. What's that? Good question. I have not looked. As of 3 or 4 months ago, they had not opened their restaurant yet. So this started in, given the economy, they very well might not have. So I go into a lot more detail. This is the first, third plus of my book was why this would be occurring. I say it's the confluence of 4 developments that made something like crowdsourcing not only possible but inevitable. One was a renaissance of amateur activity. Second was simply the existence of open source as a blueprint. The third, democratization of production, is just a fancy way of saying that tools got cheaper, faster, and easier to use. And four would be the rise of online communities. And I want to leave on this because it has a lot to do with what I'm hoping to engage you folks with today. Is the last paragraph of my book, and a theme that really runs throughout it, and a theme that definitely runs throughout these two case studies that I lean on in my book, is ask not what your community can do for you, ask what you can do for your community. And my theory being that it's no accident that these two highly successful forms of crowdsourcing did not start as businesses. They started as communities. The whole idea was to provide something for like minds. And they became communities of practice, and the profits came later. So I want to jump into this study. It's sort of, you know, when I was asked, what would I like to come talk about, and you know, had been told that this was a great place to come with questions as opposed to answers, it really made me think about this study. So again, this is Darren Carroll Brabham from University of Utah. The study is Moving the Crowd at iStock Photo, the composition of the crowd and motivations for participation in crowdsourcing applications. And basically what he found out was that, let Darren tell you. One was that, in line with what my observations at iStock Photo had been, that the site itself was tremendously popular and addictive. About 80% of iStockers find their work at iStock Photo, that participants religiously visit the site, with some 92.4% visiting daily. What surprised me in Darren's study was the primacy that people put on the money they were making on the site. It's worth noting that a couple quick facts about this iStock Photo, this community. There's about 66,000 artists that contribute to iStock Photo. Is that only 4% make their primary income off of photography, and 96% are making their money in other ways. So very few of these people are really making, you know, the lion's share of their income off of iStock Photo. And given my knowledge that this was the case, and given the fact that everything I'd learned in being at iStock Photo, the forums are amazingly active. They get 37.8 forum posts a minute. I mean, it's a really active forum. What Darren found was that about 80% of iStockers find their work at least profitable, and 20% consider their iStock Photo work extremely profitable. Darren, on regarding motivations, participants feel that iStock Photo is a fun, creative outlet where they can improve their creative skills while enjoying the opportunity to make money. iStockers are largely not out to make friends. This was something that really caught my eye. Or to network with other creative people in the iStock community. It is not a site where people merely pass time when they are bored. iStockers find creating content fun and enjoyable, and it gives them the chance to do the jobs they feel they do best. iStockers feel they're improving their creative skills by participating in iStock Photo, and they are also quite motivated by money. They are also quite confident they will make money as a result of participating in iStock Photo, though it is unclear from these data whether that means directly from sales at the site, from being able to leverage new skill in non-iStock Photo employment, or a combination of both. iStockers are unsure about whether fellow iStockers can be trusted, though they believe iStockers should help each other out. That idea that they can't be, not sure whether or not they trust one another, that they are not there, in fact, to make friends, really ran counter to certainly how the company portrayed itself to me when I was there, and to some extent my experience drifting through the forums. Respondents are motivated by money and are interested in developing their own skills, not so much by the chance to make friends or network with other creative people. Much of the discourse surrounding crowdsourcing companies emphasizes that they are communities from which good ideas and products spring from, and I'm certainly promulgated this myself. These data suggest that there is more work than community building being done and warrants further investigation into the motivations of the crowd on other crowdsourcing sites. I'm at 25 minutes here, so I want to try and wrap up quickly. You know, I will say that, you know, the perspective on motivations that I crafted, you know, not just before my book, but before my article as well, was really honed through. I was influenced pretty deeply by some seminal work by actually two fellows here, although neither one of them are here today, I don't think. One is Eric von Hippel, and the second is Kareem Lakhani. And Eric von Hippel did, am I just repeating stuff everyone knows? These are your fellows. Eric von Hippel did work, you know, democratizing innovation, and this idea of lead user innovation. And he was looking way back, you know, at the 70s and the 80s of people who were passionate users of a product were actually the best able, even better than engineers employed at the companies, to create innovations for that product. And that the motivation was that, you know, yes, that they, you know, they would get a better product out of it, but, you know, that there was, that, you know, that there were other non, you know, that there was sort of a spectrum of non-monetary motivations involved. And then Kareem Lakhani did a lot of really seminal work on what motivated contributors to open source software programs, and found that, you know, he summarizes them as the primary motivations being threefold. One, that people contributed to a service they themselves found useful, which makes sense, and we see this reflected in Darren's data, and that part of it isn't contradicted. Two, a love for the craft, that and I love this, that there was, and I don't have the numbers in front of me, but that Kareem had asked programmers what they would do if they had a 25th hour, again, contributors to open source projects, what they would do if they had a 25th hour in their day. And I think 88% of them said they would program, which I think tells us a lot about, you know, if we can extrapolate that to other crowdsourcing projects, you know, open source crowdsource projects, why people are doing what they do. But C, that it had to do with an enhanced reputation. So, you know, it's not precisely that Darren's study contradicted you know, my findings. I won't go into, I could reel off the actual statistics in here, and I'm happy to send them out in an email, you know, later. But it's, suffice to say, in summary, that money was a far more important factor than I had anticipated. And the reason, one of the reasons why I wanted, and with this I'll close, why I wanted to bring this topic up now, is this is becoming highly relevant again, because in my book I had posed the question, is iStock Photo, is stock photography the canary in the coal mine? I mean, and there's an argument to say that it's not. You know, there are a lot of good reasons why stock photography as a field was really ripe for disruption. A lot of reasons why you could say, well, this wouldn't happen in journalism, this wouldn't happen in the other creative fields, this wouldn't happen in science. And I think that question is to some extent being answered right now. I posted to Wired.com last week saying I now think that stock photography is the canary in the coal mine because of what we're seeing happen in graphic design, where the same sort of upheaval is taking place. And design is a much more, you know, people can't just go out with a digital camera, you know, shoot 40 exposures, come back and have Photoshop pick the best one for them and then upload it to iStock Photo. And to be fair, a lot of iStock contributors are considerably more skilled than that, amateur or not. You know, graphic design requires a lot more training, a much greater skill level, and these sites are becoming very popular, especially now in a recession, given that the users of graphic design are much more cost conscious than they have been before. And they are, again, it follows, you know, this general model. You know, clients can come, they post a creative brief, and scores of designers or would-be designers, again, not a lot of empirical data exists to tell us exactly, you know, who these people are, but anecdotally it suggests that some of them are recent graduates, but a lot of them are people who have no interest in being a professional designer. They just like to make logos and the like. They will submit designs, you know, to fill this creative brief, you know, on spec, and then the client gets to pick one. The winner gets a nominal fee. It's far less than what a professional designer would make at an agency, and the losers get nothing. So it's a, I just am coming actually from South by Southwest, where I moderated a really contentious and I hope also productive panel in which both the designers and the clients and these sites were represented. And the designers are reacting much like stock photographers were several years ago. In fact, I feel as if it's almost a sense of deja vu, where there's a real, you know, there's a desire to sort of stick their head in the sand. There's actually a movement that started called No Spec. This was started before these sites came up, actually, but it's gained a lot of followers since then, where they're asking designers and clients to boycott these spec sites. And I think that's a, you know, strategy that's failed, that's outside. And that's it. So let's jump in.
I just had a logo made for $250 through a logo tournament.
Okay.
And it was an amazing experience because, you know, what happened is I ended up getting about, I don't know how many, 30 or 40 designers working on it, and they were literally from all over the world. I mean, maybe out of that, 10% were from the United States.
Yeah.
But the leading guy, the guy I ended up taking, was coming from Serbia. And it was clear when I emailed him about something about it separately later on. They can get around and give you their address if they want, and you can communicate directly with them. So I emailed something to him, and I didn't put enough reference in there for him to figure out who I was from his other business.
Yeah.
Though I figured since I was probably his only one, he would know, right? And he kind of writes back and goes, you know, I'm really sorry, but, you know, I have no idea who you are. Like, you know, I've got way too much of this, da-da-da-da-da. And obviously he's running, you know, and you can see it also on the site, he's running a vast design shop there. I think it's all his work, but you know, on this side. But I must also say that I was really happy with what I got, yeah. And I was really happy with the other thing they do in these sites is they show each other all the interim designs, like the contest rolls for several days, and they all can see each other's designs, so they can copy each other's designs, and you can give them feedback. You're supposed to give them feedback,
right.
So the design evolves, and it's an amazingly fast response, and you get these wildly different trajectories, you know, of designs.
The model's very successful. People, I mean, anecdotally speaking, the clients seem to love it. I mean, when I posted to Wired, there were hundreds of comments, and it was designers being like, I hate this. Established designers, you know, with the Jeremy ads, young designers yelling at the older designers saying, well, you don't have to struggle to break into this business.
Yeah.
And clients almost as a rule saying that they loved it.
What was the site?
The logo tournament is the one that I was using.
And the other two that you might want to look at CrowdSpring and 99 Designs.
So following up on that, I used worth1000.com for a...
I don't know that. What is it?
Worth1000.com, worth1000.com for a book cover contest. And so everyone around Berkman was really excited about it, and then when I posted a blog entry about it, which is a very different audience, I got yelled at like crazy.
Yeah.
And people were really
upset.
Is it
the same idea, Worth 1000?
Absolutely the same idea, basically. But it's spec work, right? So they call it, so AIGA, whatever, has these like documents against it and whatever. And then a friend of mine thought it was a great idea, so he also did a logo contest on the same thing, same site. He also liked it, but he also got yelled at when he posted about it on a different blog with also a very different audience. And it's really interesting, the reactions and how I felt like I had to, I don't know, I mean, I felt like I responded, but eventually I stopped responding because clearly these people are just from a different perspective. I'm just wondering if you have thoughts on how did you respond in your thread, or did you take it on, or?
I try to. I mean, I think of these. It's. I've run into this with crowdsourcing where people are sort of trolls by context. Like they're not trolls the way we think of them, but they're trolls in this. They've become so highly emotional. They've become so implacable. To reason, and you know, frankly, because my field now, journalism, is undergoing, arguably, an even more. A more terrifying disruption, you know, I get it. You know, I mean, I have friends out of work. I'm, you know, I have to renew my Wired contract in 6 months and I don't know what's going to happen. Like, it's scary. It's an emotional subject. So I actually approach it with a lot of sympathy, and I went out of my way. The South by Southwest panel had been sponsored by one of the companies, and I sort of rejiggered the panel to get AIGA up there on stage because I felt like they should be represented. And one of my things is I don't think, you know, crowdsourcing should be viewed from a deterministic lens. Like, it's you know, I sense an inevitability to, you know, certainly a model like this in graphic design. Certainly, if you look at stock photography, it's like, if Bruce Livingstone hadn't done it, someone else would have. I mean, they were just, you know, I mean, now Getty is licensing straight from Flickr. Like, they're taking it to the logical conclusion. But it doesn't mean that creatives can't shape, you know, the way the transformation takes place. And a lot of that is by embracing it and innovating and trying to figure out how they can, you know, fit into it. It's, you know, one thing I think is clear is that professionals are still, you know, if anything, I mean, really valuable. I mean, the professionals on iStock Photo are a really valuable component to that community. And we see this in crowdsourcing journalism models and certainly in design as well.
So in the talk you gave, your examples largely focused on highly creative forms of work, right? Yeah. Whether it's designing shoes, designing t-shirts, taking stock photography, solving complex research and development problems. These are the sorts of things that people do on their own as hobbies. You don't mention some of the other forms of crowdsourcing going on, whether it's putting up a podcast and asking people on Mechanical Turk to break it up and transcribe it, which is not a particularly creative activity, or to me, on first glance, doesn't seem like a particularly creative activity. I wonder, in some ways, whether you're sort of what almost seems like dismay at the study from the University of Utah has to do with looking at the importance of money in this space, and this not being a form of creative expression, but a form of earning for some people. For instance, someone recently on waxy.org posted a lovely sort of study where they went onto Mechanical Turk and asked people, why do you Turk? Yeah. Take a photo of yourself. And what was really of surprising about it for a lot of people was that the vast majority of the photos said for money, despite the fact that they were getting 50 cents or a dollar for this. It's one thing in some ways to sort of see a college student holding this up and saying money for books. In other ways, it's a little stranger to see someone from Lahore, Pakistan, holding up a sign saying for money, because it actually turns out in that case to be possibly one of the better ways to make money in that case. So is this the same phenomenon, the sort of highly creative crowdsourcing that you're celebrating? And the crowdsourcing where it's a whole lot cheaper for me to have my talks transcribed by people around the world than to pay someone here in Cambridge to do it. Is it the same phenomenon?
No, thank you. So Mechanical Turk was actually something that I'd wanted to bring up. So Mechanical Turk is basically, you know, again, it's sort of like this takes a simple form of like a job posting, like labor auction, except that it tends to be highly rote, incredibly ill-paid tasks. I mean, really, like, you know, 6 cents per task or 2 cents, or sometimes they even do fractions of cents, you know, to answer like surveys, do transcription. I have all my interviews transcribed via Mechanical Turk. I save 90% on what Condé Nast usually pays their transcriber. It has always been this thorn in my side, which I have to admit, my strategy for dealing with this, because it was such an anomaly, I just didn't write about it in my book. I was like, I don't know how to compass this, and because people are on its face, people have to be doing this for money. I mean, there's no reason why a community would form around transcription. Translation, yes, like translation or localization, as translators call themselves, is another industry that's been totally disrupted by crowdsourcing. Although it's worth noting, far better than newspapers, far better than music. You got to give props to translation. They got it right away and built software tools to incorporate into their businesses. Really smart, great model. No one ever talks about translation. Translation communities of translators form. Am I leaving you out? Sorry.
No, it's okay.
I've missed.
You're not required to know my work. It's another thing. Don't
worry
about it.
Sorry. showing here.
Not a problem.
Communities around transcription, you just don't see. You do see some communities of people like of how to which hits, they're called human intelligence tasks, which hits are more profitable than others. But it's sort of like the communities that form around spam. I mean, it's not, you know, it really is like, you know, how can we make more money? And the only explanation I have is that, you know, 6 cents a task, you know, is worth a lot more in Lahore, you know, than it is in America. But Amazon says that 50% of their Turkers are based in the U.S. So, you know, I'm not sure how to explain it. And the reason I wanted to bring it up today is because, you know, I mean, I wanted to come here with all devices showing and basically say, you know, I'm proud of my book, but there are things I still really don't understand. And I'm the first one to happily say, you know, I don't get how, you know, I'm not dismayed at Darren's study, but it makes the motivations to crowdsourcing projects more interesting and more complex and and more baffling.
Is it something about passion? Is that sort of the missing link that explains why creatives and why people who are motivated by translation, particularly around translating something for a cause that we believe in, are different than transcribing, which it's just hard to get passionate about?
I would say
typing, you know, somebody's voice. You know,
I mean, I definitely, you know, catchphrase I use, because it's catchy, is, you know, passion is the currency of the 21st century, because it in, you know, my anecdotal research of, you know, both the year preceding the book, where I, you know, followed it as best I could while working a day job, and then the work of the year of intensive work on the book, I just saw it again and again, where it was, you know, crowdsourcing work because people are passionate about it. And the money might play a role, but, like, people just seem to never really talk about it. And why and when crowdsourcing works, when that passion, you know, isn't there, you know, is, like I said, a bit of an anomaly. I mean, what you can say is that it's a really effective, I mean, these two things aren't mutually exclusive. I mean, they could coexist. Crowdsourcing is a really effective way to procure labor. I mean, all it is taking advantage of the efficiencies the internet created, you know, years ago. David.
You're talking about this as if it's a contradiction or an option. You just said that two things could coexist, but there's still a sense, obviously, you, in fact, didn't talk about one aspect, one sort of thing that we normally might call crowdsourcing, granting that it is your term, so you get to say.
Not really.
Because the motivation was not the one that you expected or counted as canonical. So you do have some sort of sense that this is a contradiction, whereas it's not a contradiction if you say that crowdsourcing is the activity of bringing together many people to do some labor.
Yeah.
You know, get a little more precise than that. And just add in the theory of sort of leisure class that, for some people, they're going to do it for money. And people who have leisure to pursue the things that matter to them, they're not going to do the repetitive, boring stuff that humans hate doing. They're going to do design a t-shirt. They're going to take photographs and upload them. And it's really just, you know, just economics that determines the motivations, but that's true for a lot of what we do. And the crowdsourcing is a unitary, it can be discussed as a unitary phenomenon without having to worry that it falls into two pieces. Unless the real thing that matters to you and perhaps to the media that took this from three hits to 660,000 in a few weeks, is that this is taken as a symbol for a change in how we construe the basic motivational structure of humans.
I wouldn't necessarily go that far. I mean, you're sort of, I will admit to emphasizing, a possible contradiction a little bit because I really wanted to provoke discussion. I mean, the fact is with 66,000 contributors to iStockPhoto, there's no reasons why, a panoply of motivations can't coexist even within the same contributor. I mean, I don't necessarily think that they are mutually exclusive. But in the second part of your question, you raise something that is much of a lot of concern to me, which is how crowdsourcing is construed. I mean, and I guess, you know, to be frank, how my work on it is construed, because I have really gone out to, you know, this cardinal rule is something that I observed. I put at the very heart of my book, of my work on my blog. And so if it's to the extent that, that it's a flawed thesis, that's of great concern to me.
I'd like to say that I think you're putting a little too much faith in that study. I looked up the methodology and it's 635 people, which is less than 1% of who you said is on this site.
Yeah.
It's not a good sampling methodology how they got the people to answer the questions. So you don't really know who actually answered this survey.
Yeah.
So I think for you to walk away and have all these big thoughts and discussions about the findings of that study, I don't know. I don't know if that's really worth it. I think you're going to need to look at better studies.
Sure. No, I mean, and I wouldn't. I mean, and there's a reason why I didn't. I mean, you know, when I first saw the study, I was in like literally the last 2 weeks of writing the book. And so my first thing was to call Bruce at iStock Photo and say, you know, you've seen this, what do you think? And he had a lot of the same problems with the methodology. That, you know, basically said that it was a, you know, there was no weighting of the sample. I mean, it was the 635
it was
people who decided
there are a lot of, yeah, and it's not just who decided, because it's people always make decisions, but it was some banner thing that we're not even shown, and he doesn't tell us. It was, you know, it's not like people were contacted, like contact a random sample of participants. I mean, it's a really bad method of getting these respondents. So I think you should sort of walk away from that study to some extent and not let it affect you so much.
Yeah.
Well, better studies.
You should focus back in the way.
Okay, yeah, sure.
Please. I just wondered, I'm not quite sure how to ask this question, but when I first got the book, what was exciting to me about the concept was the possibility of its applicability to solve altruistic problems. So I just wondered...
That's what excited you, I'm sorry?
What was exciting to me? I'm from the developing world, and I just thought to myself, there are so many problems where I come from that can be solved utilizing this type. And I just wondered if you had any examples.
Well, one's sitting here, didn't you say you're with Ushahidi?
Yes.
Sure, I'm on the board. But.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if, I mean, the crowdsourcing label's been attached to you guys. I haven't attached it to you guys. I don't know if you want
to. We very self-consciously attached it to it, simply trying to ride on your celebrity and fame. And also trying to get people to understand what it was that we were trying to do.
I mean, are you familiar with?
No, we can talk about it after.
Okay.
But I'm not.
But there's another one that I'm going to throw out that was started by a couple of wonderfully idealistic, entrepreneurially minded, 21-year-olds in D.C. called the Extraordinaries, and their whole idea is take that Mechanical Turk model, where people are just performing rote tasks, but have it so people can do it on their mobile phone while they're sitting on the bus, and have it be transcription for nonprofits. Have it be, you know, what image identification for nonprofits. I mean, to tell you the truth, they have not figured out great uses for it, but their software seems to be pretty good. And I think these kinds of ideas can be really powerful. Like, there was not a lot of, philanthropically, targeted crowdsourcing examples to look at when I first wrote the book, but I'm really excited because if we're talking about passion, there's a lot of untapped passion. And people love to, if they can, you know, help out a nonprofit, you know, their favorite cause while sitting on the bus, I think they'd gladly do so. So to the extent that we reduce the friction to you know, contributing your labor toward a good cause, I think we'll see a lot of neat stuff emerge.
One example that you don't mention, I think, is as a computer scientist, I think is fantastic, is reCAPTCHA.
Yeah.
Do you know what CAPTCHAs are? The things when you enter in, you know, like this word to sign up for a new account. It's a way of stopping bots and scripts signing up for email accounts. So the CAPTCHA system was invented by a few researchers from Carnegie Mellon, and they came up with something called reCAPTCHA, which use it. So it's reCAPTCHA, and they use the images of books that have been scanned that couldn't be OCR'd. So instead of typing in some random letters that Microsoft or Google comes up with, you get two words, one of which has been previously identified by another user, and another one that's never been identified, that's never been typed in by before. And so slowly, people are able to go through large numbers of books that have never been successfully turned into text. Really, really cool system. Yeah, people are doing
it. Thank you very much.
People are not doing it for money. They're not doing it because of love, but they're doing it because they want to use the services that are being protected by the security tool. It's a way, I mean, and I guess a similar but not so beneficial for society tool is spammers getting people to fill out CAPTCHAs in exchange for looking at porn. But that one isn't nearly as interesting. So, you know, if you're a bad guy and you want to send spam, you need lots of email accounts. And the best way to do that is to sign up for Hotmail. And rather than paying people in China to fill these out, you just get people to do it for free as part of the process.
Yeah.
So it's really cool.
Wow. I'll look at it. Thank you.
There's another one, spammernot.org.
that I don't think is incredibly popular, but the idea is essentially it takes, you know, image spam, puts it in front of a bunch of people, and then people can say, is this spam or not? And then it feeds into a pretty...
filter.
Yeah.
Yeah. Neat. Cool. Back, sorry.
Yeah. I'm an amateur photographer, and one of the things I recently come across a lot on blogs and forums is, you should do stock photography. It's so great. You can make a lot of money from your photos. How could you lose? Follow this link. And so I started being, that's actually the first I heard of the micro stock photography. So I started looking into it out of sort of curiosity because I'd seen the tone of these messages before. And of course, all the links are referral links. So I think of this particular canary has kind of a dirty underbelly to it, where iStock Photo is one of the better ones. They give a $10 referral fee for a new member.
Yeah.
A lot of them have actually a Amway style structure where you get somebody in. And so, yeah, sure, you can, you know, it's actually kind of hard to take good stock photos. So if you really want to make your money, you can get some photos in there, you make a little bit. But the real way is to get some good photographers working under you on the pyramid. So a lot of the...
I had no idea.
A lot of these things, yeah.
I did know, I mean, you know, by reputation, you know, I don't want to name specific vendors because some may be reputable and some may not, but I really looked at iStock Photo because it was by far the largest purveyor.
And they are, they do have just, like, their referral thing isn't a pyramid scheme, but they do still have a referral thing like all the other ones where it seems like it's a little bit seedy. And like, so that may tie into the money motivation thing in some way.
Well,
I don't know if it's cause or effect or...
It also, it's because it's such a volume business, it sort of raises the issue of you know, that they are, that they may just be in a desperate need to continue building this. I mean, it's a massive, you know.
But what's seedy about multi-level marketing? What's inherently?
Maybe C is the wrong word. It's certainly spammy. It causes these, from my point of view, my annoyance with it is it causes people to make posts that are allegedly helping people, but really are trying to trick people into following their link into getting into the thing. And so they don't really know if you're going to make money off of this. And it's probably unlikely that you're going to make anything approaching, you know, the cost of, you know, a memory card off of your thing.
And just my concern about it is to the extent that it becomes integral to an iStock Photos business, then, well, maybe it's not all about the community. Maybe it's just about, like, getting more people to join. It just, you know, to the extent that it becomes... you know, more crass, it becomes, it
less and less.
Yeah.
In some sense, the other big situation where this happens a lot is politics. And I know you haven't really touched on it, but... Yeah, but, I mean, in the Obama campaign, that image, actually, that you have in the back of your laptop, that is, in some sense, a crowdsourced image.
Yeah.
So to what degree do you see that playing back and forth with the political world?
So my official argument on my blog was that Obama was crowdfunded. So crowdfunding is this gets silly, but someone had coined this term crowdfunding, you know, after my article, and I, you know, I thought it was a really nifty model, and I write about it in my book. The example I love and utilize Kiva.org, and that actually goes to your question about philanthropic activities, but and you know, the argument I make, and it's a little you know, it's a little, it has some holes in it, is that by being quantitatively different, Obama was qualitatively different, because I mean, he also had some real big corporate contributions too, but he did have just, you know, an exponentially larger base of small contributions. Whether or not he's crowdsourced, I tried to make the argument, and I was persuaded by one of my Wired colleagues who covers politics that he was not. He was like, you know, having these operatives planted in these communities, that a lot more of this stuff that we think was created by the crowd was either created by the crowd kind of at the behest of an operative, that what he had really succeeded at was sending professionals deeper into the ranks of the community. I have no idea of knowing whether or not that's true. I from, you know, my admittedly, you know, sort of, you know, cursory observations, you know, I've not done a lot of research into the campaign. I've not spent a lot of time talking to people running the campaign. It seemed awfully crowdsourcey to me, but...
Yeah, I mean, just...
And the question now is whether or not... I don't think there's any question that it's affecting politics. It's whether or not it'll affect government. So my question is, what is Obama doing with the Citizens Briefing Book?
Well, yeah, no, I mean, I don't know. And the fact is promises of transparency notwithstanding, he's not telling us what he did with it, at least not in any communications I've read. So the Citizens Briefing book, he used the exact same software that Dell and Starbucks have used for their own crowdsourcing stuff. And the idea was to have people come in, make suggestions, vote on those suggestions, discuss those suggestions, get them up to the top. And it works great for innovations in laptop design, which is what Dell used it for. It created the Citizens Briefing book for Obama. It was a four-day experiment. But as far as I've seen, there's no indication of how that's actually, you know, gone into policy formulation. My suspicion is that it hasn't. Like, is Rahm actually being like, wait, what did people want? I don't see it.
They want to reform marijuana laws in this. I don't know if that's still at the top of the list.
I think Axelrod would say,
you know what, maybe we should consider some other things as well.
I mean, I'll tell you, on the ground in the campaign itself, there was an interesting setup. There were a lot, when they went into the caucus states during the primary, one of the things that they did was use the online community to self-organize, and then when the organizers, the professional paid campaign staff went out there, there were already self-organized communities that said, oh, thanks for showing up. Here is, you know, this person runs that, this person runs that, this person goes and knocks on doors, this person records data, and whatever. And so one of the ways that the Obama campaign out-organized the Clinton campaign on the ground in the primaries was through self-organizing through the website. But in the general election, when they when everyone's campaigns were all joined together and it was sort of one big enterprise, I was in Pennsylvania the last 4 days before the election, and I went out there to help organize a small college. And I've worked on many political campaigns, and normally on the ground it works this way. You have an organizer who works for the campaign, who reports up, and then people come and they work for the organizer. This was substantively different because they still had this organizer who was in this local town and sort of helping people get together, but there was a completely separate entity of volunteers. So you had a house that the volunteer said, from money that they donated, they rented, they made it their office. There was a person who came in who was a volunteer who spent an all day staffing the location, telling other volunteers how to go, where to put their resources, whether to call. And the only job of the organizer who worked for the campaign was to report up the results and to be responsible for the outcome. But the whole operation itself was entirely volunteer-driven by local, self-organized volunteers from the community, which is very different from the normal political model of, let's bring in a person, and then we'll gather volunteers from lots of outside areas and drop them in.
I would like to interview later, because I'm currently doing the foreword for my paperback, and I'm going to... I didn't have a lot of Obama material when I was closing up the hardback, but I'd like to talk to you more. Thank you.
At one moment in your talk, you used the word labor force, and then you changed it to community.
Yeah.
So, and then the book has the title crowd sourcing. So, I mean, crowd is a wonderfully ambiguous word. But I wonder if you could talk some about the problem of finding the right language for whatever these things are, because they seem so various in the examples you've given. Some of them seem wonderful and useful and new, and some of them seem exploitative, and some of them seem like they're going to put professionals out of business, which might be a good thing, and some professionals we might still want.
Yeah, so. I think again, device is shown here. You've put your finger on personal ambivalencies I have. I mean, is crowdsourcing exploitive? I certainly see the potential. Ask a professional designer, they'd say yes. I mean, here's a pro-exploitation argument that David Carson, fairly iconic designer, made on my panel the other day, is creatives almost, back through the ages, and certainly now, the supply of creatives always exceeds the demand for their labor. So we become really meek people. I mean, why have I killed myself working for Wired magazine? Well, I don't get benefits, but I mean, tons of people would love my job. I mean, you think I've ever like gone to renew a contract and said like, I want health benefits, or there's no union that supports us. There's no union for designers. And so the argument, and I think it's a pretty good one, is that, people, designers may not want those 50 designers that create a design for you. They may not be that psyched about it, but they don't see any other way, and they'll sort of take what's handed to them if there's any expectation of making money for doing their creative work, because they do love their creative work. But I'm of two minds, and they're not entirely reconciled, because looking at the same case, looking at design, I can say, but look at all these people who could not afford to go to design school, who are retired designers, who just simply love what they do. In the book I use this, highfalutin language, and I believe it emotionally. Crowdsourcing is a liberating force. That it liberates what I think previous to these technologies, previous to these business models, was latent creativity, stuff that was not being expressed. There was no outlet for it. The tools weren't available for people to express it. All I can say is ambivalent. Yeah, I mean, you're right, and a close reading of the book would probably show that there is an effort to reconcile the language used in describing these phenomena.
London has been very
patient. Yeah, sorry. I've been trying to spread it out.
Yeah.
That's okay. I wonder if you have any data or have any reference to the demographics of this crowdsourcing community or community of people who are willing to work for very little or for free. Is it mostly a bunch of college kids who then fall off that crowdsourcing group when they get actual work, or is there any numbers around the demographics?
Because you also work on a crowdsource project, which
exactly.
May be.
You're with Herd.
Right.
Okay,
so you know about it. Okay, sorry. I did mean to talk.
I would love to talk to you.
Talk to you right after.
Yeah.
This.
Okay, I would love to know who's using Herdic, although I'm not sure it's it's expressly aimed. I know you can use it in the U.S. too, but what I can say, and it's based on thin empirical data and a lot more anecdotal data, is not nearly as youthful as you would think. Aspersions on his methodology aside, which are probably well deserved, I mean, Darren's median age was like 38. And I think that may not be too far off the mark. I mean, I think it skews, a Threadless certainly skews young. It's a lot of young designers, but there are plenty of older designers using it as well. The real answer to your question is I don't know. Mm-hmm. In fact, one of the reasons I was psyched to come here is I was like, who knows of empirical data? Like, tell me, because I'm dying to see it and don't know of a whole lot.
Charlie, you want the last word?
Oh, fine, thank you. I'm not much on empirical data.
Good ideas.
And I do completely empathize with your angst at the core of your profession. It sounds like a lawyer speaking about the joys of exercising the skills and yet the doubts about who we allow to hire us and how we implement. But I was actually snagged on something that Rob said, which, if I heard it right, was that Obama did one of these crowdsourcing things, and up to the top of it came reform of marijuana, and we're just letting it sit idly there and not rising to it as something that, after all, if he beats us down on this, what else have we got?
they dismissed the question, Charlie, basically. They dismissed it in a very joking way.
They used like 50 words to say no in a very structured, like, press secretary.
Sorry, that's
sort of
not
way.
Going to be our priority.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was sort of the...
Well, see, he's a loser.
Yeah, but then they stopped prosecuting it.
No, they didn't.
In states.
They reversed that order.
If you go with the crowd, don't you have to respond to the crowd?
Not the stone crowd.
Guess not.
So we are out of time, but Jeff, thank you so much.
Great. Oh, yeah. Thank you all.